This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So along that vein, there's also this statement that I heard during one of the presidential debates, and I think I've heard in some other settings in kind of popular culture that not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslim. Now, again, like, we have Google, so we know this is not real.
Yeah.
Right? Like, terrorists come, unfortunately for our world, in all shapes, sizes, religion, gender, or across the board. Terrorism is not... No one tradition has a monopoly on that.
Absolutely not.
So I think we can clearly dispel that myth. Again, we have Google. It's pretty clear.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have a newspaper, and fortunately we have other politicians who are combating that notion, including the mayor here in Dallas who has pushed up against that.
Right.
So I'm curious, like, where do you think this notion comes from? Why do you think that is getting, like, a foothold in popular culture?
Sure, sure. In 2015, there were over 300 mass shootings in America.
Yeah.
Only two of them were committed by Muslims.
Yeah.
But the amount of media time that those two shootings got was more than 298 other shootings, right? And we are quick to assume, if we can find a Muslim name when an attack happens, if there's a Muhammad in there, if he looked a little brown, if she looked like she might have been, right away it's a terrorist attack before the facts are put out there. Right, you know, and even San Bernardino, the terrible tragedy of San Bernardino, a lot was lost in that, by the way. Number one, there was a Muslim lady that's a board member of a mosque over there in California that was shot three times. She didn't die, thankfully, but she was shot three times. So this clearly wasn't about Muslims going and killing a bunch of non-Muslims. Number two, the whole thing about, you know, right away you had candidates jumping on it, you had people jumping on it. This was ISIS. ISIS has come to America, so on and so forth. Turns out that the whole thing about the young lady giving a pledge of allegiance to ISIS turned out to be a complete sham. It actually never happened. So we completely throw out all the nuances there. Mental health is thrown out. Workplace is thrown out. Unstable families are thrown out. Everything that gets afforded to every other killer is thrown out. If you can somehow associate that person with Islam, Islam is to blame. So it's not true historically. I mean, we just exited the most violent century in world history.
Yeah.
There were almost 250 million people killed in the 1900s.
Yeah.
They weren't killed in the name of Islam. They weren't killed in the name of Christianity, actually. I mean, there's this thought that religion is responsible for violence, right?
Right.
They were killed in the name of fascism. They were killed in the name of communism. They were killed in the name of democracy. Here in the United States, there was this thought before World War II, though you and I weren't around, right? But there was this thought that Russia and Germany represented two evil ideologies. Let them kill each other off. One of them will kill the other one off, right? Because you had all these ideologies. Lo and behold, they weren't Islam. They weren't Muslims. Historically, if you just search the bloodiest conflicts in history and the death tolls, the ones that were killed in the name of Islam are very, 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 very small. Now, here's the response to that people give. They say, yeah, well, you know, fine. Christianity worked out its mess in the Middle Ages. It's Islam's turn. But even today, that's not true. Statistically speaking, that's not true. When it comes to suicide terrorism, there was a book written by Robert Pape called Dying to Win, where he traced every suicide bombing. The origin of suicide terrorism, Japanese kamikazes, they're not Muslims, or at least I don't think they are. The Tamil Tigers, a secularist group, not Muslims at all. And basically, he shows how every single suicide bombing in history, even in modern history, traces the last 100 years, was carried out for a clear political goal. It was not carried out for a religious goal. It was carried out for a clear political goal. When we look at...
Is there a religious incentive in Islam for that kind of martyrdom?
To go out and just kill people?
To kill people, sacrifice yourself in the process to advance the faith.
So there are a few things here. Number one, it says in the Quran that whoever kills a soul without right, an innocent person without right, is as if he has killed all of mankind.
Mm.
And whoever saves a life, is as if he has saved all of mankind.
Mm.
Again, you're not allowed to kill women, not allowed to kill civilians, not allowed to kill children, so on and so forth. to summarize, you know, there's the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he did say that la tatamanna liqa'a adu, which means don't ever wish to meet someone in battle. Don't wish to meet anyone in battle. Okay? So you should not look for war. You should not look for violence and so on and so forth. However, once a battle takes place, once there is, so the Quran does talk about defending the innocent and defending the oppressed and fighting for just cause. Just war is not uniquely an Islamic concept. This is a concept that exists in every system. Yes, there is a lot of there's glory for those who die in just war and die in just. I mean, here in the United States, right? When it comes to the U.S. military and so on and so forth, there's glory in defending a just cause. So yes, that is certainly there. The reward for martyrs and so on and so forth. That's there. That's talked about. But that doesn't mean going out and killing innocent people. And if we're going to call out everything that happens by a Muslim. Peter Bergen, who's a national security correspondent, he recently wrote a book called United States of Jihad. Okay. And he said that since 9/11, the amount of people killed, I believe those killed in the name of Islamic terrorism, we're talking about 15 years now, we're about 43. Those killed in the name of white supremacy, we're almost double that number, right? Why is that not terrorism? Okay, why is Dylann Roof not terrorism? The guy was posing with flags. He clearly had an agenda, a political agenda, when he went there and shot those people as they were worshiping. Why is that not called terrorism? I grew up in Louisiana. I'm from Louisiana. So I grew up seeing the Ku Klux Klan, their rallies. They popped up here in Irving recently, right? We didn't even know that they were still around, but they popped up here in Irving. That's in the name of Christianity. Is Christianity to blame for that? So statistically speaking, less than 2% of Muslims are radicalized. Less than 2%. Now someone says 10% of Muslims, are radicalized. That's a terrible thing around the world. You're focusing on a very small section of the community because it fits your ideological agenda. So,
but part of the recruitment effort on the part of ISIS, right, mm-hmm. is appealing to some of the very things that you talked about, right? Is appealing to a lack of justice. Is appealing to some of these places where the world has treated people unfairly,
right.
And the part of the recruitment for ISIS is to stand up for the oppressed.
Sure.
And so in the midst of this, and if you were to encounter someone who is watching ISIS recruitment videos or who has been recruited by ISIS or is considering, being a part of a radicalized group, and they say back to you, but look at the oppressive systems that are in place, and don't we have a responsibility to fight against that? What's your response to that person?
First and foremost, just sort of on the previous point, we have to treat these cases with all of its political nuance. We have to look at them with a comprehensive lens and not just associate religion with it. So people are not in healthy context. It's not like people are sitting in Malaysia or in Turkey or so on and so forth. Those are probably bad. Turkey's probably a bad example now because Syria's next door, right? But it's not people that are coming from healthy backgrounds and healthy countries that are suddenly reading the Quran and getting radicalized, right? There are Buddhist monks that are killing the Burmese off in the Central African Republic. Christians that have wiped out the Muslim population, or people that claim to be Christian, people that claim to be Buddhist. In Kenya, there was the news story that came recently where a terrorist group, again, claiming to act in the name of Islam, tried to attack a bus full of Christians and Muslims. And they told the Muslims, get off the bus so we can attack the Christians. And the Muslims stayed on the bus and protected the Christians against this crazy group, right? So first you have to treat it as a political group. It's not religion that's making them do these things, that's appealing to them. So then what does that leave us now to with these extremist groups and so on and so forth? Well, Iraq has been bombed by 4 consecutive presidents. It's a very unstable political situation. Syria was left out to dry. Bashar al-Assad killed over 200,000 of his own people, and we did nothing about it. So when those countries go to hell in the political sense, in the economic sense, that becomes a breeding ground because you have frustrated people that have seen their parents killed. They've seen all types of things happen. And interestingly enough, more and more when you see what's going on with ISIS, it's a group of mercenaries, right? They're literally taking young people, giving them money, Most of them are not even being recruited for ideological reasons. It's here's your future. There's money to, there's cash here to offer, yeah. Right? How do we deal with this situation? Number one, as a country and as a group of people that are trying to fight this, we have to recognize that that we have to be very, very critical of our foreign policy. We have to look at what our foreign policy goals are, what our involvement in the Middle East is, where it's positive, where it's negative. We have to have those very uncomfortable discussions. Number two, the young people that are joining ISIS, unstable homes, depressed, you know, look at the Boston bombers, right? Isolated from their families, having trouble at work and so on and so forth. They're not going to these places for glory, for glorious reasons. They hate life as it is. Right. This is a place to go die a glorious death and to get your revenge and so on and so forth. And yeah, if I'm depressed in life and I want to end my life anyway, and then I have this guy over here promising me a glorious death and great things in the afterlife, yeah, of course, it's a very appealing message, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Even if I don't have a political goal in that, it's a very appealing message to go and get all these great things in life. But then the political side of it, what I tell young people, you know, that are thinking about this, I tell them, you know, what good are you serving? How are you making the cause of the oppressed better? How are you not making things absolutely worse? You know, by going and committing these heinous acts and doing these things. It's a very small group of people, no doubt. Yeah. But what are you doing to further these causes? And so we have to meet halfway. There are people that have very legitimate political frustrations. And we could be guilty of a 21st century McCarthyism, where, you know, just like in the 1950s, the way to silence dissent, the way people would silence dissent was if anyone questioned the United States foreign policy, they were communist sympathizers. Yeah. So now, are we offering a legitimate voice for people to voice their frustrations about U.S. foreign policy without feeling like they're going to be targeted and bunched up into, you know, into this group, and their phones are going to be tapped and they're going to be pursued and so on and so forth? Are they having that outlet? Are they able to voice their frustrations? What we have to do is we have to channel the frustrations that people have with our foreign policy in a positive direction, and how you can make meaningful change, and how this going overseas and joining ISIS actually makes things worse for your community, makes things worse for everybody. It's just your own selfish way to escape life, because you found a dead end everywhere you went in life. So we have to, it's a multifaceted discussion.
Well, and there's something heartbreaking about that for me, right? To sit and, you know, because like one of the questions I asked earlier, in part because this is the kind of thing that we hear from time to time, is, you know, whether or not someone can be Muslim and also be a patriot, right? And my understanding of patriotism that I've understood since I was in elementary school is a willingness to speak out against the government when you believe that the government is doing wrong, is doing ill.
Sure.
That is a patriotic move. And so it's sad for me to know that Muslim citizens of the United States feel silenced, feel like they can't, you know, speak their mind, that they can't voice that patriotic responsibility, which is to hold the government accountable. Without being labeled, you know, and so it's sad for me to hear.
Well, many of them do, and part of it is that Muslims don't feel like they're represented properly in the political arena. I think a lot of the population feels like they're caught between two extremes, right?
Yeah.
You don't completely associate with the Democrats, you don't completely associate with the Republicans, but there's no centrist party in the United States.
Right.
So you just have to always choose the lesser of the two evils, right? That doesn't resonate with everybody, right?
Right.
So patriotism is indeed, you know, that you love your country enough to try to steer it in a direction that you feel like is most beneficial for it. But do people feel ostracized for voicing their opinions? Do young Muslims feel like they have a voice, a legitimate voice? Or do they just feel like the only voices of Muslims that are being heard are the pandering voices,
yeah.
Right? The voices that will say exactly what the government wants to hear. So we have to create that space. And the worst thing that we could possibly do, the absolute worst thing we could possibly do, is to confirm ISIS's message that Islam and America are inherently incompatible, that you cannot be a Muslim American, that your value system is, religious value system contradicts your citizens' responsibilities and so on and so forth, that all of this is contradictory, because they want that clash of civilizations. So when politicians get up there and they say that, you know, we're at war with Islam. They're actually confirming ISIS's message. ISIS is saying you're at war with Islam. And then you're saying you're at war with Islam as a country. You're feeding into that message. And it is a fact. And this has been gone through many times in discussions of security, that the material that's being pushed out there in media outlets by politicians is used as propaganda, recruiting material for people. You know, it's sad that people, I've been overseas a few times recently. I promise it wasn't to Syria. I didn't join any group, right? But I've been overseas. I've been to the Muslim world. And you know that people in the Muslim world genuinely think that all Muslims are about to be thrown out of the country? I mean, they actually say, you know, what are you guys going to do if you get banned? How are you going to... I'm an American. I don't have another passport. This is my only... What are you going to do if you get banned? Where are you going to go? You know, what are you going to do if Donald Trump becomes president? Are you going to run away? Are you going to leave before they kick you out? So that type of rhetoric is absolutely destructive. And we have to be very, very careful not to feed ISIS's machine by saying, indeed, Islam and America are inherently at war, and that you are a paradox. You can't be a good American and a good Muslim at the same time. We have to actually make people comfortable with the idea of being great Muslim Americans that can contribute, as we have been doing. I mean, millions of Muslims here are very successful, very well integrated. We're one of the most integrated communities in this country, economically and politically and so on and so forth. So it can happen, but we can't feed that message.
Just, I'm kind of curious, as someone who's a leader of a community that sits in that awkward and difficult in-between space, when there are times like this past fall, when armed protesters showed up at the Islamic Center in Irving, right outside of the place of worship, and at a time that people were coming in for worship, there are all these messages that give a sense of like, you don't belong here. And I'm curious, like, what spiritual resources do you offer your people as they're going through times like that? Where do they find hope? Where do they, how do they navigate through the difficulties that come with being a part of a society, but not really? We're feeling like you're a part of society at work, and then you show up for worship on Saturday and find out you're not.
Right.
So how do you navigate that as a spiritual leader?
The first thing we teach our community is forgiveness, the quality of forgiveness. Hmm. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when he was struck in the Battle of Uhud, which was the second battle, major battle in Islam, he was struck into a ditch and he was hit in the head and his teeth were knocked out. And he said, Oh Allah, forgive my people, for they don't know any better. And so we teach people that same message, like they just don't know any better. If you know, they don't know you, they don't know any better. They've been, literally have had hatred funneled into their minds and hearts for however many years. Give them a positive interaction. Make them think twice. Show them your good side. Don't let them teach you bad character. You teach them good character. Don't let them teach you to hate. You teach them to love. And so we have to respond with that grace that we're taught to respond as. And that's what we all feed off of in our faith traditions, right? Grace. Respond to evil with grace. And so if I'm at a restaurant, and look, Islamophobia now, the way that Muslims are treated now, especially Muslim women, literally, many of them literally wearing their faith on their heads, right? The way that they're treated, it's a daily thing now. You're flipped off on the highway, you're run off the road, you're yelled at Walmart, your waitress treats you like garbage, your professor is discriminating against you. The dirty looks, it's become part of our daily life here, right? And what we have to do is not let that make us negative, but instead we have to respond. We have to rise to the challenge. And the challenge is, can your heart expand enough to where you can respond to all that negativity with something positive and with mercy and with love? And you can actually make that waitress think twice next time another Muslim comes into the restaurant because you responded with a smile and you made them think twice about what they did or what they said or how they looked at you. The greatest challenge is that our kids, a lot of Muslim kids are asked, have asked their parents, are we going to get kicked out? Are we going to live? Because you can imagine what damage it does to the psyche of a child that's going to the mosque and seeing people holding big guns outside and chanting go back home and yelling terrible things at them. So it's an uphill battle, but we'll get through it. And it's not the first time it's happened in America. right? It's our turn. But we'll be okay. We'll make it through it. And I think we'll be just fine. And I hope that this will be a learning experience. It'll be an opportunity for us. And we know election years get really, really, really bad because we are the whipping boy of every politician out there that wants to gain some sort of approval and ignore true political issues and just focus on this Muslim community because we're just a political liability. So we have to, as a community, become more engaged. We have to counter those negative interactions with positive interactions. And I think we'll become a more... We'll be in a better place after this is all done. Hopefully it won't take long. And hopefully we'll be in a place where we can help other people that are being discriminated against as well.
Well, and for what it's worth, as just a drop in the ocean, though, you know, I have this church that operates a coffee shop, right? We operate in the coffee shop. We are the coffee shop. It's messy, but it's great. You know, one of the things that I count as a personal victory every day is a day doesn't go by that there isn't someone there with a hijab. That there isn't someone who I know is Muslim and they feel comfortable there and they feel welcome there. Sure. And that holds incredible value for me. And I know that there are others for whom that's the case. Yeah. And I hope that there are more and more ways for those stories of hope, for business leaders, for religious leaders, for others to know that that's a value and that's who we can be here in Dallas, and that's who we can be in the United States. I'm grateful for the tenacity that you offer, the surprising amount of patience that you offer in the face of what feels to me like injustice in my place of privilege. That when I look and see, it feels unjust. It doesn't feel American. So I appreciate your surprising amount of patience in the midst of it.
We're grateful for people like you that can see through all the nonsense, right? And that actually have open hearts and that actually have open minds and that are actually able to talk to us and interact with us and see through all the propaganda and the hatred that's out there. Yeah. So we're far more grateful for people like you all, you know, and having you in our midst. And that's what gives us hope. I mean, really it does, because it shows us that there's a different side to America than what's being portrayed out there, right? And we know that, that it's not everyone is out there calling for a war, right, on Islam and for us to be banned and deported. But there is a significant group of people, there is a significant amount of people in this country that still want to see America become that tolerant, pluralistic, place that accommodates people of all faiths and all colors and creeds.
Well, there is power in conversation.
Yeah,
the ability to actually sit down and hear from someone and those conversations. If we're really going to get into the issues and really understand, you know, we said earlier how religion is difficult to understand and figure out. It's not conversations that take place in 5 minutes, though. That's a good start. If we're going to truly do our duty, I believe as people of God, I believe as Americans, whatever the case might be, if we're going to do our duty to figure out how to live together well in society, to walk with one another in integrity, to stand by our principles, it takes time invested in conversation.
Absolutely.
And so I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be in conversation with you today. My hope is that this is the first of many. My hope is that we might inspire some folks who are watching to engage in conversation, to talk at someone, whether it's in the parking lot at Walmart or whether it is by inviting someone over for dinner or accepting that invitation to try, you know, the cookies that some wonderful woman has baked.
If you bite twice and nothing happens, then most likely
you're good. So that's my hope out of this, is that so much of what we hear about Islam in America comes primarily from politicians, it comes from pundits, it comes from people who are offering 10-word answers. And I believe that we're called to something more. So I hope that this is the beginning of a lot of conversations, not only for the two of us and for folks who are here with us, but for all those who are watching and for us as a nation as a whole. That as individuals, as corporations, and as media companies, and as political parties, we can engage in more fruitful conversation and dialogue to bring about a better world. So thank you. I really want to appreciate your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.